I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. George Zimmerman was acquitted of second-degree murder and manslaughter in the shooting death of Trayvon Martin. A jury of six women delivered their verdict Saturday night after 2 days of deliberation. This case and this trial, which was televised, became a Rorschach for opinions about race, self-defense, guns, and profiling. We asked Eddie Olbaum to join us to talk about this trial. He's director of trial advocacy and clinical legal education at Temple University's Beasley School of Law, where he's a professor of law. He's also a former senior trial lawyer with the Defender Association of Philadelphia. And Eddie Olbaum, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. It's nice to be here.
When you strip away everything, what did the prosecution have to prove in the in this particular trial?
Well, they made it initially much more difficult for themselves than they otherwise had to. They charged, or in my view, overcharged him with second-degree murder. That means they had to prove that Zimmerman acted with the kind of intent that the law characterizes as having a depraved mind or a hatred or a malice or an evil intent. They also charged him with manslaughter, which is a little difficult to understand, and the judge made it even more so with her instruction. And manslaughter means that they had to prove that George Zimmerman acted intentionally. He did it in a way that was beyond negligent, and that what he did was not justifiable or excusable. You know, ultimately what this case boiled down to was who started the fight. And did George Zimmerman have the right to self-defend?
But do you think the prosecution had different options besides second-degree murder or manslaughter, which was added at the very end of the trial?
No, they could have. They didn't really have any other options. In my view, what they should have charged him with from the very beginning, removing all ambiguity, was manslaughter, which was more easily provable, although still, I think, somewhat difficult.
Well, in fact, you say the judge gave confusing instructions to the jury?
I think the manslaughter instruction was a little cumbersome. It was difficult for me to follow, and I teach this stuff. When they came back again and asked for clarification, she didn't give it. I think there may well have been confusion, but of course none of us was in the jury room.
Well, as you said, when you boil it down, the question is who started the fight? And the problem is that one person in this fight is dead and the other person was on trial. That's a question that it's hard to find the answer to.
No, that's exactly right. On some level, the prosecution was handicapped. They did not have a victim who was able to tell a story that competed with George Zimmerman's account. Now, of course, they made life even more difficult for themselves by putting on all of Zimmerman's statements, thinking that the jury would be concerned that Zimmerman was inconsistent in certain respects. But as his defense team, I think, ably pointed out, some of the inconsistencies were somewhat minor, and the jury now had his account and didn't have Trevor Martin's.
But do you think it would? I mean, would it have ever made sense to put George Zimmerman in the witness stand?
You know, I don't know. I didn't talk to him. I think that the defense would have had a much more difficult call to make had the prosecution not offered any of his statements. In that respect, I think the jury would have needed to have heard from him. I don't know how else the self-defense account would have emerged. It's likely that he would have testified had the prosecution not offered his statements.
But
the defendant can't offer his own statements in a case like this. He can only testify. The government, the prosecution, had the opportunity and took it of offering all of the statements that the defendant had provided.
Now, obviously, there were no actual witnesses to what happened that night. We had that tape, and there was a question about, I guess both sides claimed that they knew who was yelling on that tape.
Well, that's true, although actually my recollection is that there were some witnesses who came forward to testify about what they saw. In fact, one of the most compelling witnesses and what made the case exceedingly difficult for the prosecution was a man by the name of John Good, who lived in the area, testified that when he looked out, he saw a darker man on top punching and pummeling a man who was wearing a red or a white jacket. Zimmerman was wearing a red jacket at the time. And this was a guy who didn't seem to have a dog in the fight, who at least raised more than reasonable doubt about who at that point in the altercation was the assailant.
Well, when it comes to self-defense, and even when you look at the Florida law, what is the criteria for self-defense?
The criteria for self-defense is whether or not the defendant has an actual belief that deadly force is required to propel the onslaught, and whether that belief is reasonable. So it's both a subjective test. Did he actually believe that he needed to self-defend, right, and that the amount of force that he used was proportional to what he was facing, and would a reasonable person in the defendant's position have believed that as well?
And yet, as we understand this case, it was George Zimmerman who was told by the police not to get out of his car when he called to say that there was someone suspicious in this development. There were certain things that he did that appeared to have precipitated this incident.
You know, that's absolutely right. And that's what makes this case so fascinating and so difficult. You know, I guess the way I asked myself the question in preparation for our discussion was, can we respect the jury verdict and then still conclude that Zimmerman got away with something? And I think so for the following reason. Even if we buy the fact that Zimmerman's story, that Trayvon attacked him at some point, you know, who was responsible for initiating the chain of events? It was Zimmerman. Who was following who? Zimmerman was the follower. Who was carrying the gun? It was Zimmerman. Who ignored the police's urging to stay in his car? It was Zimmerman. Who thought that the other was one of, quote, them, which was his statement? You know, who thought that someone else is about to get away with something? All of that was Zimmerman. Now, to be fair to Zimmerman, he told the police that the reasons why he was following Trayvon Martin was because Martin looked suspicious. It was raining, and Martin, according to Zimmerman, was sort of wandering about, and that Martin appeared to be high. So, you know, maybe the bottom line question is, if Zimmerman had seen an unfamiliar white kid or Hispanic kid wandering around in the rain who appeared to be high, would he have even called the police? And if the police said, don't stand your ground, stay in the car, and leave it alone, would he have been that persistent?
Well, and George Zimmerman was a member of Town Watch, but not a member of the police department.
That's right. That's right. I mean, you know, George Zimmerman, I guess if I'm the prosecutor, I'm calling him a junior Rambo. You know, he's out and about, and when the police say, we have it under control, we'll take care of it, he says, no, I'll take care of it. Now, under Florida law, he had the right to follow somebody in his neighborhood, and he had the right to carry a gun.
And at the same time, we have, just to underscore this, then an unarmed 17-year-old boy with no criminal record who was going to a 7-Eleven to get some Skittles and a soda, walking back to his father's house or his father's girlfriend's house in a development.
That's exactly right. He absolutely had the right to be there. He certainly had the right to stand his ground as much as the law allowed George Zimmerman to stand his ground. That's exactly right.
But did the prosecution say that Trayvon Martin had a right to stand his ground, or would that not have been admissible in this courtroom?
No, it would have been admissible, and a number of folks, and I include myself in that mix, really believe that the prosecution got out-lawyered. There were a number of mistakes that I think the prosecutor made, and that I think you just isolated one of them.
What would be another?
The lead detective actually was permitted without objection to testify that after talking to the defendant, he believed the defendant's story. You could have knocked me over with a toothpick. I've never heard of a lead detective in a case where the prosecution calls the detective and have the detective testify that, having heard from the defendant, the man whom he is prosecuting actually told a story that he thought was credible. That was one mistake. The second mistake, of course, was that the defendant, the defense lawyer, talked about how Trevin Martin was armed by a piece of concrete, or by using a piece of concrete, and he very dramatically pulled in a piece of concrete and put it down on the floor in front of the jury and wiped his hands and wiped off his clothing and said this is what he was armed with. Mm. Of course, the site of death was the grass, which was 25 feet away. So how do you move from the point of the armed weapon, according to the defendant, and put the decedent and Zimmerman on a grass 25 feet away, a point that I don't think the prosecution hammered home in closing? Those are two.
Well, and I know that there are more. Let me ask you about the jury. A jury of six, which to me is unusual and perhaps interesting. All women. I don't know how right. significant that is. And my understanding is at least five of them were white, and I'm not sure the race of the sixth member of the jury. Is that an important issue, Eddie?
You know, it is an important issue. Jurisdictions, according to the Supreme Court, can seat a jury with as few as six. Florida has taken advantage of that. Most jurisdictions, including the one in which we sit, requires a 12-person jury in a criminal case. In order for the prosecution to convict, you need all 12 jurors. So on the one hand, to the extent that there were six, the prosecution only had to convict six people. One might say that that makes it a bit easier for the government to meet its burden of proof of beyond a reasonable doubt. You only need six. You don't need 12. You know, I'm not sure this case boils down to gender. I don't think the fact that these folks were women had anything to do with it. I quite frankly think that based on the evidence that I heard, that that jury heard, and they certainly heard more than I did, and they saw these people, unlike most any of us, and given the way that this case was tried, I don't think the jury could have done anything other than to have found him not guilty. That's the way the law's supposed to work. The defendant is cloaked with a presumption of innocence. The government's got to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. A tie goes to the defendant.
This is a case that obviously got national attention, and it was televised as well, and it has sparked a discussion about race and profiling and guns and stand your ground and self-defense. Is a case like this, Eddie, and we've about a minute before I have to say goodbye to you, is this a good kind of case for a discussion like that?
You know, in some ways, it's a wonderful case to talk about those kinds of issues, and in another way, we need to be mindful of the fact that cases are tried in courtrooms shaped by evidence and law with burdens of proof and statutes. They're not sociology laboratories where we examine social questions raised by the media, all of which, of course, should be examined. But to fault the jury for not coming up with a statement about the aspect of race and in the criminal justice system is to fault them for doing something that they're never, ever charged with doing.
And my understanding is the Justice Department is looking into this case, I guess, to see if there are some civil rights violations. Is that pretty typical?
It is. Well, it's typical. It's certainly where folks have gotten together and asked the Justice Department to do that. I'd be surprised if they prosecuted George Zimmerman for a civil rights violation. The burden of proof is increased. They're going to have to prove that what motivated George Zimmerman was racial animus, and I'm not sure how you're going to prove that.
Well, Eddie Obam, we tracked you down yesterday, and I thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. That's Eddie Obam, Director of Trial Advocacy and Clinical Legal Education at Temple University's Beasley School of Law, where he's a professor of law, talking about the verdict in the George Zimmerman case. We'll be talking about New Jersey politics, election politics, right after this short break. We've got two guests waiting in the wings. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Have you lost weight in the past 2 years? Drexel University is conducting a study designed to help people prevent weight regain through exercise. In this 10-week program, you can learn how to make lasting changes to your exercise habits, which may help you avoid weight regain. If you have lost weight and want to exercise more, you may be eligible. 215-762-8400. 215-762-8400. Drexel supports WHYY.
Kerouac and Ginsberg may have passed on, but beat scholar Simon Warner says rock and roll is still on the road.
Indie kids get in vans, they travel across the states, they play gigs, and I think the Kerouacian spirit is alive and well still in those gestures.
We talk about the intersection of rock and beat poetry this week on Sound Opinions.
Watching America roll by.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, states like Texas and North Carolina are passing new restrictions on abortion clinics, but will those laws stand up in court? Also, sequestration has had effects all across the government and all across the country. We'll take a look at how it's affecting Head Start in Cincinnati. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Voters in New Jersey have the chance to go to the polls in three elections in the next few months. There's a U.S. Senate primary in August, followed by a special election in October to fill the seat of Frank Lautenberg, who died earlier this year. Newark Mayor Cory Booker has a commanding lead among the Democratic candidates, as does former Bogota Mayor Steve Lonegan for the Republican nomination. Then there's an election in November for governor, and Chris Christie is running for re-election and is being challenged by State Senator Barbara Buono. Well, today we want to talk about Garden State election politics with two keen political observers. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studios is Matt Katz. He covers New Jersey Governor Chris Christie for the Philadelphia Inquirer and writes the Christie Chronicles blog. And Matt Katz, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here, Marty. Thanks.
You're welcome. And on the telephone is Daryl Isherwood, editor of PoliticerNJ.com. That's New Jersey's online source for political news, insight, and commentary. And Daryl, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
And to our listeners, especially our listeners in New Jersey, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I do want to talk with the Senate race, about the Senate race first. And Daryl, let me toss this first to you. Why is Cory Booker so far ahead?
You know, Cory Booker is one of the few guys in really in the country right now who's got that kind of rock star personality, rock star persona. And you know, the guy sort of transcends New Jersey politics. I mean, he's, you know, you look up and there he is on Oprah, and he's got a Rolodex full of, you know, A-list Hollywood stars. And this is sort of Cory's, I hate to use this word, but it's sort of Cory's destiny. I mean, he's always wanted to, he's had this ambition to kind of move up that political ladder. And there's just nobody else in this race, and really, you know, with the exception of Chris Christie, there's nobody in the state who can rival his name recognition and his, you know, sort of that as I said, that rock star persona, that you know, that glitterati kind of thing. He's out there in the country, and people just know who he is, and almost regardless of what he does, they want to, you know, they want Cory to succeed.
Well, what's interesting, Matt, is there, it looks like there was or perhaps still is some tension between Lautenberg and his family and Cory Booker. They called him, I guess, a show horse and not a workhorse. What do you make of the tension there? And do you think in any way it will impact this particular race?
I don't know if it will. The background is late last year, Cory Booker, who everybody was talking about him running against Governor Christie, and that was considered, this would be the marquee race if Booker and Christie faced off against each other. And Booker released a video and said he wasn't going to run for governor, but he was going to explore running for Senate. Now, Frank Lautenberg was still alive and was still talking about possibly running for re-election. So challenging the old Democratic statesman was not seen as a respectful move, and Frank took it personally, and he said that at one point suggested that Cory needed a spanking.
Wow.
So there was some tension there, and even after Lautenberg decided to retire and said he wasn't going to run, they still weren't really talking. Lautenberg wasn't taking a meeting with him. And so it made sense that the family came out and supported Congressman Frank Pallone, who had been in Washington for decades with Lautenberg. And they go back, and Pallone had campaigned for him back in the 80s. So it wasn't that surprising. Pallone put out a web ad that noted this endorsement and said he would continue the liberal agenda of Lautenberg. But I don't know if it makes much of a difference. I mean, Booker, to put Booker's dominance in perspective, he's now leading the Democratic field by a larger margin than Christie is leading in the gubernatorial race. It's over 40 points. So it's going to be tough.
Well, and picking up on that, and Daryl, going back to you, at least according to, I think it's the Quinnipiac poll showing Cory Booker way ahead. You've got Frank Pallone around 10%, Rush Holt about 8%, both of them in the U.S. Congress, and then Sheila Oliver, the Assembly Speaker, at around 3%. Again, just sort of underscoring his dominance. Any comments on that, Daryl?
You know, it's interesting. This put him over 50%. You know, the first poll put him at 49%, and then again, the closest competitor was 10%, or maybe he was at 48%. But you heard people saying, well, he can't get over 50%. Well, now he's over 50%, which means if you add up all of the votes out there, including undecided, Cory still wins. The problem you're seeing right now for both Frank Pallone and Rush Holt is they're the same guy, virtually. You know, they're the same candidate. They've got a very similar record in Congress, very similar dynamic, very similar background with both of them. So they're just taking votes from each other at this point, and neither one of them really is cutting into Cory Booker's lead. And so it's really creating a no-win situation for both of them. And what was interesting is I had talked to a Republican operative not long ago who said something to the effect of, these guys must really hate each other. You know, had it been us, we would have worked it out with whoever we were running against, and one of us would have bailed out. But both of these guys think they're the right candidate for this job, and really all they're succeeding in doing is keeping the other out. Not to say either one's going to win. You know, either way, if Rush Holt dropped out tomorrow, Frank Pallone might get another 10%, but he's not going to win this race. Sheila Oliver, to date, has been sort of a non-event. She's polling okay, I mean, considering, you know, where the others are.
Yeah.
But she hasn't done a whole lot. She sent out her first fundraising letter last week, which, interestingly enough, dinged Cory Booker. Everybody seems to be trying to ding Cory a little bit. But she's been a non-event. And there was a school of thought in the beginning that thought maybe she'll take some votes away from Cory, being the other African-American mayor or candidate in the race. There was some thought maybe she'll dig into Corey's lead. Hasn't happened so far, and you know, with a month left, it's sort of doubtful that it will. But she made her first foray into the race last week.
I wonder, Matt, as someone who covers Chris Christie, there, you know, there was a point in which Cory Booker and Chris Christie looked like they were having a little mini bromance, as we say these days. Do you think Cory Booker is helped by Chris Christie's popularity in New Jersey?
I don't think it has hurt him. I mean, this is the governor. Half of Democrats in the state think the governor deserves re-election. So the idea that his association with Christie would really be a problem hasn't proven to be the case yet. And there's still a bromance there. I mean, they're still friends. They were both in Idaho last week at the Allen Conference, where all the moguls and big shot political stars hang out. And they agree on several things, particularly in terms of education and education reform. And it'll be interesting to see if Booker's in the Senate and Christie's reelected, how that relationship continues, especially as we move on to 2016.
Daryl, just a quick question about, and it probably deserves a long answer, which we don't have time to, but was Cory Booker, is he a good mayor of Newark? I mean, if you want to look at accomplishments, can New Jersey voters look at Newark and say, here's what Cory Booker did for that city?
That's one of the most loaded questions in the state right now. I think a lot depends on who you ask, but I think that has always been sort of the ding on Cory, is his record in Newark. I mean, Newark is maybe a better place, but it certainly still has its problems. But the real answer to that question is I'm not sure it matters.
Really?
I think that had Cory run for governor, it could have mattered more because the ding would have been on his executive-level experience, but he's running for Senate now, and as I started out saying, he sort of transcends the position of mayor of Newark. He's sort of, I hate to say above it, but he's sort of beyond that. And so I don't think people look at him as mayor of Newark and I need to study his accomplishments to know whether he'd make a good senator. So I think in reality, whether he's got a stellar record or not, I'm not sure it matters to the average voter.
Interesting. Now, Steve Lonergan, Matt, is running way ahead of a Dr. Alieta Eck. Well, like way ahead.
Way ahead.
Well, what do we need to know about Lonergan?
Lonergan is he's a hard right conservative. He lost to Christie in the gubernatorial primary in 2009. He was the former head of the New Jersey Office of Americans for Prosperity, which is a Koch brothers affiliated group. He is essentially the Tea Party candidate, if you will. And he looks like he's running an aggressive campaign. He's the only candidate in either of these races to have any sort of public event so far in Camden.
Really?
And he went there on Friday to blast the welfare state and to blame the welfare state for the reason why Camden has so many troubles. So, and he's going to unapologetically run against Obamacare. He doesn't look like he's going to move to the middle at all. So if Booker, and he's already been attacking Booker relentlessly. So if things work out the way we expect, and it's Lonergan Booker, it'll be an interesting and a very the race. You'll have two candidates to pick from that'll contrast each other greatly.
Would you agree with that, Daryl? Then we'll get to some of our callers.
Yeah, and I will say this, too. Steve's just good at this. Steve has run for statewide office a number of times, and he's also been the head of Americans for Prosperity. So he knows what he's doing with these sort of campaigns. And as Matt said, absolutely. I mean, there are two pretty hugely contrasting candidates there. I don't think there'd be any question of who stands where in that race, in that general election race.
Do you think there's a strong Tea Party constituency in New Jersey, though, Daryl?
You know, I don't know about strong. They have a presence. He should get the Tea Party vote, but I'm not sure I'd classify him as necessarily a Tea Party candidate. New Jersey's considered a blue state. Steve will tell you otherwise, but New Jersey's considered a blue state, and I think Steve knows what he's doing with these campaigns, but, I just see it being all Cory Booker.
And that's Daryl Isherwood. He's editor of PoliticerNJ.com. And Matt Katz with us here in our Philadelphia studios covers New Jersey Governor Chris Christie for the Philadelphia Inquirer, writes the Christie Chronicles blog. We've been talking about the race for the U.S. Senate to fill the seats left after the death of Senator Frank Lautenberg earlier this year, a race that shows that, at least so far, Cory Booker with a commanding lead and a commanding lead for Steve Lonergan as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. If you live in New Jersey, you will have a chance to vote in August, October, and November. Will you do that? Give us a call. Let me see what Gary Stein has to say. Gary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
I was telling the screener, I'm a candidate for New Jersey Assembly. I'm running as an independent. I'm suing the county clerk here over the design layout of the New Jersey ballot and the Atlantic County ballot specifically, in order to have a judge make the ballot similar. And this is where the Inquirer reporter, Mr. Katz, might be interested. The ballot in any other state but New Jersey is set up fairly, and I've checked. I've seen the ballot. I've asked for the ballot sent to me. I've checked online. 49 states have a fair election ballot. New Jersey's doesn't. And that's part of the reason you might have this special election, by the way, because in any other state, if Cory Booker was on the November ballot, he'd be directly, Cory Booker would be directly above Barbara Buono in the same column, line. They'd all be using the same slogan. Slogans, you don't have that anywhere else in the country.
Well, Gary, let me take your point and give our guests a chance to weigh in on that. And actually, since he mentioned you, Matt, your response.
Well, I don't know exactly what the issue is. I'd be curious to hear more about it. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you that the reason why we are having three elections is because Christie had a decision to make about when to schedule a special election. And he said he did it. He wanted an election as soon as possible. But what we have is we have 2.5 weeks between the Senate election in October and the gubernatorial election. So there was a lot of questions about why he wouldn't just schedule the Senate election for his election in November. It would boost turnout. It would be less confusing for voters, et cetera, et cetera. It would save money. And the suggestion that he repeatedly denied was that he didn't want to be on the same ballot as Booker, just as the caller said. Because if he was, you have a popular Democrat. There was concern potentially among Christie's people that he would have some coattail effects with Buono, and Christie wouldn't have the same sort of margin of victory that he is banking on.
And Daryl, just picking up on the ballot design, it's hard to talk about it on the radio, but do you think Gary Stein has a point there?
To be honest with you, I don't know enough about the issue either to know if there is an issue there. Going back to Matt's point, I think he's 100% right, though, in terms of the reason for the special election. I think it just simply had to do with what helped the governor and what was defensible in court, and I think this was under both of those tests the obvious answer.
Let me see, Gary. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what George from Mount Holly has to say. George, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
All right. So thanks, and I'm wondering. I actually have another comment now that I heard what the source of one of your guest speakers is.
Well, let's take your first one, but go ahead.
Right. The first one is, okay.
You got to be paying attention, George. You're on the radio.
Sure. No, I understand.
Okay.
So, Mr. Katz, is he in any relation to Carla Katz? And the other thing is, you guys keep continuously quoting the Quinnipiac poll, and during the race between Corzine and Christie, the Quinnipiac poll actually showed Corzine getting elected. And obviously, it shows an obvious bias. And I keep wondering why you guys keep quoting that obviously biased and skewed poll.
Well,
when you're looking for real hard numbers,
fair enough.
The outcome of race will be.
Let's take your point. Go ahead, Matt.
First of all, no relation to Carla Katz, former Governor Corzine's ex-girlfriend and union leader. Although maybe I'd have better sources if I was. Secondly, every poll across the board has shown Christie with a 30-some-odd point lead. Quinnipiac, Rutgers, et cetera, Monmouth, and the margin of victory with Booker right now is all been pretty comparable to around the 40-point range. So I know there are issues with certain polls in the states, but it's been pretty consistent. So we look at all of them.
And how about for you, Daryl?
You know, and I would say this, too. You're not talking about 5-10 points here. You're talking about 30 and 40 points. So even if it's skewed a little bit, I can't imagine it's skewed enough to put either any of Cory Booker's opponents or Senator Barbara Bono, you know, anywhere near a dead heat with the opponents.
And I'm just curious about having a primary in August, Daryl. I know you're not a predictor, but it's just hard to imagine how much voter turnout, which is in the middle of a very hot month when many people are on vacation. And many people are vacationing at the New Jersey shore, but nonetheless.
I do this for a living, and I'm on vacation that week.
Okay.
You know,
I
think we're looking at an election with historically low turnout there, and you know, I think it's going to be an election that's decided by the people who really care about politics. I don't imagine there's going to be, you know, huge turnout levels. And I think to the caller's point, I think that makes this election harder to model.
Sure.
But I also think, you know, again, you're looking at the hardcore voters, ostensibly people who have at least somewhat followed these races and followed the candidates. So it's a strange time. Again, you know, I think you're right. You're going to have people scattered all over the country at this point. It's, you know, that is prime vacation season, the month of August. And it's, you know, I honestly think that helps Cory Booker as well, because he's got the best name recognition on the ballot. So, you know, all of these things, I think, you know, while you're going to be looking at low voter turnout, you are going to be looking at people who know at least something about the race.
And that tends, Matt, we're almost having a break here, but primaries tend to be, even when they're in non-vacation months, tend to be the time when really committed voters go to the polls.
Yeah, and on the Democrat side, that often means public employee unions, but they are in a predicament this year because they would probably support one of the two congressmen or even the speaker, as opposed to Booker, who's been more for school choice and some things at the and pension and benefit cuts, things that the public employee unions don't like. So, but in this case, since they have three candidates they could support, they're mostly staying out of it. And that means they might not have the same sort of ground troops they normally would in a primary, which goes to help Booker.
And that's Matt Katz. Again, he covers New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, and we will be talking about Chris Christie after this short break. He covers the governor for the Philadelphia Inquirer, writes the Christie Chronicles blog, joining us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Daryl Isherwood is editor of PoliticerNJ.com, New Jersey's online source for political news, insight, and commentary. And we're taking calls about New Jersey election politics. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. If you live in New Jersey, give us a call, 1-888-477-WHYY. We'll be right back.
Bold, honest, engaging. Tell Me More is a safe place for honest conversations. Our guests are people you know and presidents trying to rebuild nations.
The war has ended in Sierra Leone. The whole country have made a strong commitment to move forward.
Tell Me More brings you the news from across town and around the world. So join us next time.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, religion scholar Reza Aslan, the author of a bestseller about Islam, has written a new book about the historical Jesus. He says he was a Christian for a time as a teenager after his family fled Iran for the U.S.
Part of the conversion experience for me was trying to feel accepted in this new country, trying to feel as American as possible.
Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Compulsive shopping is the butt of many jokes, but for some people, it becomes an obsession, buying things needlessly, exhausting their bank accounts, often wrangling with depression because they just can't stop. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, a look at compulsive buying disorder, an addiction that's little studied but can be all-consuming. Today at noon here on WHYY FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. We are talking about election politics in New Jersey. There's a Senate primary in August, a special election in October, and a general election in November. Some interesting lopsided matchups. And our guests are the Philadelphia Inquirer's Matt Katz and Daryl Isherwood, editor of PoliticerNJ.com. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I do want to talk about the race for governor. I'll go first to you, Matt Katz, as someone who covers Governor Chris Christie. You know, it's been said before, he's a reddish or pinkish governor in a blue state, and yet he seems to have a lot of popular support.
That's right. The amazing part of this race is, I mean, he is a conservative guy. Issue by issue, it's hard to find an issue where most New Jerseyans agree with him. He is the only reason why there's no gay marriage in the state. He vetoed a gay marriage bill. Most New Jerseyans support gay marriage. He's pro-life. Six family planning clinics have closed because of his cuts. Most New Jerseyans support our abortion rights. Most New Jerseyans still think property taxes are a huge problem. In 3.5 years, property taxes have gone up, and they don't blame Christie for that issue or really any other.
They afraid of him?
Some are. I think the overarching thing that's going on here is that people just really, really like him. They like that he kind of yells at constituents and reporters at times because it seems authentic. He does not seem like a politician, and that engenders trust. They also like the fact that he embraced or quasi-embraced Obama days before the election after Sandy. The moderate voters in New Jersey look at some Republicans around the country, like Michelle Bachmann, who they think is way too far to the right, who just are against the president no matter what. And then here you have a governor who actually allowed himself during the heat. I mean, this was 6 days before the election when Sandy hit. And he allowed himself to praise the president in order to do what he said was best for the state. Mm. And his numbers skyrocketed after that, particularly among women. I think both of those things together, the likable personality, the quote-unquote leadership after Sandy, have just made him something of an unstoppable force in the state.
Do you see it that way, Daryl?
I do, and there's another element there that I think also, you know, goes beyond just his accomplishments. There is this narrative and this feeling that Christie has just shaken things up, that he has taken on some of these sort of untouchables in the past, public sector unions. I mean, in the past, under specifically, you know, Governor Corzine, those were untouchables, and Christie took them on unapologetically. The teachers union he took on unapologetically. And I think people just see him as willing to fight the hard fights. And whether or not, you know, his accomplishments are enough to warrant people to say, yeah, he's doing things down there, people just see him shaking Trenton up. And I think after a long time of sort of status quo, property taxes on the rise, pension and benefits, the pension system going broke, I think people are looking for someone to say enough. And you know, I've had this discussion with a number of people. What has he done? What accomplishments can you point to? And there are a few. I mean, obviously, there's a couple of big things that he's accomplished. But I think more than that, people, just as Matt said, they like the guy. They like what he's doing. They like his personality. I think they trust him to watch out for their benefits for their interests, because in some sense, he's one of them. Now, he has this everyman quality that I think people really gravitate to.
Well, let me pick up on the gay marriage thing, and it's interesting both to you, Matt, and to you, Daryl, after the Supreme Court decision, which essentially gave federal benefits to gay couples living in states that have same-sex marriage. He's really tossed this to the voters, right?
That's what he wants to do. The Democrats and pro and gay marriage supporters don't want to do that. They say civil rights should not be decided by the whim of a ballot measure. He rejected an actual law in this regard and said
he vetoed it, right?
He vetoed it. And he said, let's put it on the ballot. And there's a potential for the Democrats to override that veto, but they would need Republican votes. And their new line of argument is that Christie intimidates Republican legislators to such an extent that they can't vote their own way. And the Democrats say, just let Republicans vote their conscience. Governor, the legislators talk about how they've seen their Republican colleagues walk out of his office crying, and they don't want him to intimidate them on this issue. But, you know, this might be decided next month by a court, and gay marriage could happen in New Jersey in the matter of weeks, theoretically. So this might not actually affect Christie at all come November or beyond.
But do you think by what he has done that he has positioned himself for that, what appears to be a potential run for national office within the Republican Party? So he can say, I vetoed same-sex marriage.
Sure. I still think it's a prerequisite to be against gay marriage in order to win a 2016 presidential Republican primary. And he certainly has checked that box. He vetoed gay marriage. New Jersey and Pennsylvania are the only states in the Northeast without gay marriage. And in New Jersey, that is solely and squarely because of Governor Christie. And he'll be able to sell that if he needs to on the campaign trail in a Republican primary.
But, Daryl, the Assembly could override his veto. But as Matt said, the Democrats need some Republicans. Do you think that would be an interesting thing to watch over the next couple of weeks, what the Assembly does?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, as Matt said, the Democrats have come out and said, hey, vote your conscience. There's some hypocrisy there because certainly not every Democrat voted their conscience the first time this came up. I guess it was 3 years ago. So there's a little bit of hypocrisy in that statement. But the Republicans have shown themselves to walk almost in lockstep with the governor. And it's really worked for them. I mean, it has really worked for the Republican Party to be relevant in the legislature, despite the fact that they don't control either house. They are relevant because they stay in lockstep with the governor. This is an issue. You know, I don't know that these legislators would be quote-unquote allowed to buck a Christie directive to vote any other way but the way the governor thinks. But also, as Matt said, it might not matter. You've got a couple of different ways that this could go, and it could be decided by a court. And going back to that 2016 narrative, Matt's absolutely right. Christie has checked that box on gay marriage. But on a state level, he has also said, hey, look, I'm willing to put this on the ballot. I'm willing to let the voters decide and abide by what the voters decide. So he's sort of positioned himself in this middle ground, and he's very good at doing that, by the way. He has positioned himself in this middle ground to where, you know, he could pave the way for gay marriage, or it could happen if it were to be put on a ballot. Certainly the majority of New Jersey residents support gay marriage, according to polls. So, you know, but again, when he goes out on that trail in 2016, he doesn't have to explain why he allowed gay marriage in New Jersey. He just says, hey, I vetoed it. I don't believe in it. I vetoed it.
I mean, he's covered all his bases, hasn't he, Matt?
Right.
That's true. I was going to go beyond what Daryl said, just picking up where he left off, that he's also the middle ground in that he said that he doesn't think homosexuality is a sin. He's a Catholic, but doesn't think it's a sin. He thinks people are born gay. But he thinks this is a thousand some odd year old institution that we shouldn't tamper with. So he really has it's a very nuanced opinion on gay marriage. It's kind of unusual in that regard.
Well, but Daryl, and this is, you know, getting in the head of Chris Christie, which is probably not a good thing to do. But nonetheless, the presidential, the next one is 2016. Let's say he wins governor of New Jersey. He would only serve out about half of his term, or not even that, if he were to run for president in 2016.
Yeah, he would serve out, you know, it depends on what he decided to do in terms of his run, when he announced, when he started campaigning, you know, if he would resign the governorship immediately or at what point he would do that. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's a pretty, you know, poorly kept secret that he's got that ambition. And if you look at the polls, he's at least among the front runners in the Republican Party. So I think he's going to take a long, long, hard look at that. And if I were betting, I would say he's going to go. Obviously, you know, you've got at least 2 years now before we start getting into who's running, who's not. And a lot can happen in that time period. 2 years is a long time in politics. But I would say there's a good chance that he's going to jump into that race.
Do you think so, Matt?
Yes.
I'm looking at your face here. Go ahead.
I'd really be shocked if he didn't. There are a new poll out saying that he's down by 6 points from Hillary, so he's got 3.5 years
something
to make
like
that. Up that ground. So I mean the conventional wisdom is that he'll have a harder time almost in the Republican primary because he's viewed as a rhino Republican in name only by some conservatives, but it probably depends on who else is in that field.
And what do we need to know about Barbara Buono? Go ahead, Matt, and then to you, Daryl.
She is a liberal, longtime legislator from Middlesex County. She is not. At one with the party leadership, the party bosses, the party power brokers. She has staked a decidedly more left-wing stance on a lot of issues. Democrats in the state, the Democratic leadership in the state supported Governor Christie's plan 2 years ago to cut public employee pension and benefits. This was his landmark signature issue. Daryl mentioned it earlier. Buono voted against it. There's like you would have in a Senate race between Booker and Lonergan, there is a contrast here, for sure. So far, she's been running, focusing a lot on social issues. She's pro-choice. She's pro-gay marriage. Today, though, she released an economic plan, an 8-page summary of her economic plan, and there are certain elements there, liberal or progressive elements there, increase the minimum wage, restore Christie's cut to the earned income tax credit, which helps the working class, set up some sort of public-private investment bank for urban centers. There's not a ton of details, but I mean, it's something to chew into, and we might see her now kind of shift things to really focus on those bread and butter issues, money and taxes and pocketbook issues that people really vote on.
Mm. And Daryl, I mean, it sounds like she's got a hard road to hoe.
She really does. It's a tough race for her. She's had money issues. She's had messaging issues. You know, the fact remains, she was handed this nomination almost by default because she was the only one who wanted to get into the race. Now, that goes to her credit. You know, she jumped in unapologetically. She was in early. She would have been the first one in, no matter who jumped in. A lot of hemming and hawing from other candidates, Cory Booker, Dick Cody, people like that. Ultimately, nobody wanted to take on Christie, and she did. That said, she may not be the best candidate to take on Christie, and her campaign has had myriad issues in terms of trying to get a coherent and cohesive message out, deciding what they want to run on. You know, they've been focusing a lot on social issues, but social issues don't win statewide elections. I mean, she's not going to win an election on gay marriage, especially in a state where, you know, property taxes are high, we've got high unemployment, things like that. You don't win on social issues. And so she's really got to focus more on some of these, as Matt said, the economic, the pocketbook issues. But you're not getting any traction there. And it's a self-perpetuating problem because as she gains less traction, these polls continually show, this is the point Matt made earlier, you've got polls across the board that have universally showed her 30 to 40 points down. Mm. And as that happens, that becomes the reality. People don't want to give money to a losing campaign. And so she then, the money issues perpetuate themselves. And it just becomes harder and harder to compete, especially on the other side when you got this guy raking in money. He's able to continually go up on TV in the most expensive markets in the country. And all of these things just seem to snowball and get worse and worse. So she really needs to get to a message, stick to that message. And fundraising is going to really be, you know, a major issue for her in the next couple of months.
Matt, you had an interesting piece over the weekend. I guess it was yesterday in the Inquirer about, and you mentioned this earlier, that Governor Christie vetoed $7.5 million in family planning services for a particular kind of family planning in services in New Jersey, almost comparing and contrasting what is happening in New Jersey to Texas, which, of course, has gotten so much national attention because it's been sort of fought out loud with filibusters and protests and demonstrations in the I guess, in the their particular legislature.
Sure. With a Democratic legislature in New Jersey, Governor Christie's pro-life views aren't going to manifest themselves in a rollback on abortion laws, but they have potentially in the way he's eliminated five times now this annual appropriation for family planning clinics like Planned Parenthood. Now, Christie attributes this entirely to fiscal issues. He said, this is a redundancy in services, I'm giving money elsewhere, but it's viewed through the abortion lens. And the argument that Buono has tried to make and what is shaping up to be something potentially, Tara was talking about the messaging issues.
Exactly.
This could be a theme for her. She's saying he's only rejecting this money, he's hurting women because he wants to run for president, and he's trying to show that he closed Planned Parenthood clinics. And she's able to make this argument on gay marriage. She's able to make this on the cuts to the millionaire's tax, which she wants to reinstate. This could be a possible theme that she has trotted out. I mean, she's been more often in recent weeks talking about 2016. She put out an ad last week saying, with a backdrop of cornfields in Iowa, and saying, you know, Governor, this isn't Iowa.
Oh, interesting. And certainly New Jersey is not Iowa, but we do have to end on that note. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Darrell Isherwood, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. He's editor of PoliticerNJ.com. That's New Jersey's online source of political news, insight, and commentary. Matt Katz, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And he covers New Jersey Governor Chris Christie for the Philadelphia Inquirer and New Jersey politics as well. He writes the Chris Christie blog. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program, including a Facebook, Twitter, email, archives, satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.